Do you like the Star Wars? Welcome to the Rancor Pit, because we like the Star Wars too. I'm Cole, Jedi Cole Houston, and with me as always is the intrepid, the intergalactic, the most wanted scoundrel.
They call me Eddie Starhopper Medina.
Oh, wow, Starhopper.
No relation to Jax, because he's no rabbit, apparently.
Oh, yeah. We ain't no rodent.
I'm sorry, Jackson.
Yeah, Jackson ain't no rodent. He'll be the first one to tell you.
Rodent, there you go.
For those of you who happen to pick up the latest, one of the 6,000 covers of Star Wars number one that came out earlier, tail end of last week. This is, of course, the Rancor Pit, and this outing, Eddie and I were kind of pressed. We hit one of these points where we're like, well, we've got a lot of topics.
Uh-huh.
And we don't remember exactly which one we planned on next.
And then part of that was, now that we're, well, we should be used to it by now because it's coming up on a year, but now that we're doing this as a weekly, we're finding less time to research between pre-recorded shows.
That is the truth. This little show, I was be damned if it was going to have another weekly show, turned into a weekly show. We've been having a blast with that between this show and the Rancor Pit Live, which if you haven't watched the Rancor Pit Live, shame on you.
You're missing out.
Can see this sort of thing and discover the what I always call the DJ syndrome, that we looked nothing like what you imagined.
The DJ syndrome.
Yeah, most people I'm fairly certain were probably laboring under the misapprehension that I look just like a shaved Wookiee, which is not far from the mark, but I'm told the reality is like
nobody wants to see a shaved Wookiee.
Yeah, that's the truth, especially Wookiee, another Wookiee, an unshaved Wookiee. But this time we hit upon the idea of, why don't we talk about an aspect of Star Wars that is very close to, I think, most fans, and that's the spacecraft and the starfighters, your capital ships, your various conveyances that will take you through the stars. But then Eddie pointed out that kind of leaves us with a whole lot of other cool stuff untouched.
Mm-hmm.
If it can't get into space, we ain't talking about it today. But what about all the neato?
Yeah. Because as soon as Cole dropped the topic on me, my mind started going in all these different directions. And then I realized, oh, wait, we're talking about interstellar craft.
This is going to be too narrowly defined. Uh-huh. And it would take too long to talk about, like, every single vehicle. We would wind up, you know, having to promise to touch on the subject again sometime and then forget we ever mentioned that part.
Yeah.
So, quite cleverly, what we're going to do to allow ourselves a little time to research in a few weeks for a different kind of approach, we're going to follow our previous trilogy with a biology? I'm not sure what one calls that.
Yes, it's going to be a biology, and we're going to get the football coach to teach
it.
You know, because we all know coaches make such good
That's
teachers.
So true. And they inevitably get saddled with biology because they're the only ones who can stomach the lab practical.
Nice.
So, yeah. We're going to open up a Gungan here and see what it looks like on the inside.
Oh, yeah, or those little frogs that Jabba eats.
Oh, that's
That'd
right.
be more...
So,
yeah.
What we decided to do was sort of break this into two parts. And this side of the thing is going to be your intergalactic, anything that can go in space.
Uh-huh.
And then in 2 weeks we'll come back and we're going to talk about all of the amazing land craft and terrestrial craft. You know, from your land speeders and speeder bikes and snow speeders and other things with the word speeder in them to things like the twin pod cloud car or some of your other, like your weird little Wookiee dragonfly copter ship. And which will get obviously the least coverage of any of these vehicles.
Oh, yeah.
And if we really wanted to be just completely bold and give you a really, you know, how stretched into an hour topic, we could break this into a trilogy and have Beasts of Burden, but we're really not gonna. I mean, there's only a handful, and I don't want to, you know, pad out 20 minutes on the Bantha.
Well, and we kind of touched on creatures during our North Texas Comic Book Show Live episode.
That's so true. That's so
but,
true.
Yeah. Well, I guess so, we should get in. Should we get into it?
I think we should get into it. We should right. climb on board. And I think there's no better place to start when you talk about, you know, in the flavor introduction on the JCU website, I mentioned things like, you know, if you're going to do intergalactic sci-fi stuff, one of the first expectations is you've got to have some way to get from one planet to another, one into this galaxy to the other, or what have you. And the better you do that, the more memorable your finished product becomes. And certainly Star Wars, just from the moment you're introduced to this galaxy far, far away, you're given some of the most memorable StarCraft ever created.
You know, that's a good point. I never thought of it. This is another thing that sets the Star Wars universe apart from other sci-fi universes, in that to get from point A to point B, they're using spacecraft. Whereas, you know, Star Trek, you have wormholes that kind of help you cheat a little bit. Stargate, you actually have, you know, like a portal, I guess. But Star Wars doesn't have anything like that, at least nothing that springs to mind, unless there's
something...
You pretty
much had to drive around a lot. I mean,
yeah,
for the most part, they had to do that a lot in Star Trek, too. They just kind of like, that's why it took 5 years.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of it was just the driving, you know.
I guess it wasn't until Deep Space Nine where they kind of introduced the
wormhole. Yeah, the wormhole is a handy little bit of science fiction. Just add, you know, just ask Interstellar. Not Interstellar. That was a great damn movie, but nonetheless, but you know, right out of the gate, what do you start with? Is you get this amazing, you know, here comes this spaceship blasting onto the screen.
Yeah,
and it looks like it's a pretty big spaceship.
Yep,
this is going to be pretty cool. But wait, here's another spaceship, and it's still going. And it's still going. Is there no end to this thing? And then finally, you see the engines. Like that's a big ship.
And that made such a big impact on everybody.
Oh yes,
on everybody, young, old. You know, those going in very interested to those who are just going in just out of curiosity. I think that really cemented this is going to be something, folks, that we have not seen before.
Oh, exactly. And then to underscore the scale. The monumental scale is you have the first ship swallowed whole by the second ship.
Yeah.
And there's still room for more stuff. I mean, they got like, you know, they could knock a wall out and build a rumpus room.
Yeah.
They've got all kinds of space left. You know, we can take your ship on board and still have room for three or four more ships.
Yeah. And that's the cool thing about that in particular, that image. And it's repeated. It's very subtle. But in a way, it's repeated in episode one, because you had the MTTs, that transported
the
battle
droids. Yeah, the ship that was chock full of ships that were chock full, or vehicles that were chock full of droids.
You had that one big ship that looked like...
It was like if you had a gun that fired a bullet
or something.
Full of bullets.
Yeah. So, like, when that opens up, you know, you find out, like, in these reference books that it carried multiple... things of the battle droid transport cruisers, and on top of that, the tanks and just about everything.
It was a cool looking ship.
Oh yeah,
And that was the other thing that's so unique is Star Wars really embraced something that early sci-fi didn't.
Yeah,
and that is, you know, once you're in space, you can drive bricks or houses or porcupines. It doesn't matter what your ship is shaped like. You don't have to worry about aerodynamics. So you might need a rocket ship to get Flash Gordon off of Earth or off of a planet, but once you're in space, you don't really need the rocket ship anymore.
Exactly.
Of course, it does beg the question, how does your flying hamburger with the olive on the side manage to make planet fall? But I'll link you to the Jedi Justifications that explains how things like TIE fighters can go flying around in the air.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's a very simple process given to you right there on the screen. But
taking it back to the example you brought up, you know, the opening sequence of A New Hope, that was such a powerful image that, you know, after that, and we kind of touched on it briefly on the Me Too episode, other things started copying that. Like when you had Battlestar Galactica, they tried to match that type of imagery where you had the Galactica and they had the camera pulled in really tight and it would pan across the side of the Galactica to give you that.
Oh, exactly. It would just sort of crawl by like you're watching some great cruise ship leave port. You're expecting a bunch of streamers to be coming off the side. Yeah. And everyone's wishing them bon voyage.
Yeah, exactly. And even more.
And then the Cylons attack, just like Carnival Cruise.
Oh, no, sir. That's wrong.
No, that wasn't Cylons. That was some pathogen. Okay, different.
And to make it even more painful, a more painful example would be the Star Trek The Motion Picture, where they had to pan over the Enterprise like 25 minutes.
Yes, it was sort of like, look what we made, Mom. And even to the point where you had like the little guy in the spacesuit waving.
Yes!
I mean, at that point, like, who's going to see you, little guy in the spacesuit, you know?
Exactly.
It's like, you know, I can see Daniel waving goodbye.
And who's so self-centered that they feel the need to wave at the galaxy?
Or, of course, it could be that it was they're obliged to, like, you know, when the train crosses
Six
Flags and the poor hand who has to, you know, put the little chain up has to wave.
I worked at Six Flags and I was so thankful when I didn't get that job.
Oh, yeah, that is probably the most thankless job
those,
in the
those
world.
Those were the people that got three strikes against them and that was their punishment.
I think the only thing worse at Six Flags was working the kennels, which I did not realize were there.
Kennels?
We'll go into that on another show. Talk about dogs and Star Wars. But yeah, there is actually kennels there at the park.
That must have been gone after I got there. But anyway, back to the topic at hand.
Welcome to Six Flags Cast, where we talk about Six Flags over Texas in depth from people who went there and people who worked there. But no, that set a precedent that continues to deliver throughout the film.
Yeah.
Because then you're introduced to the Millennium Falcon. You get your flying hamburger. You get one of the most unique spaceships because there's still a symmetry to everything up to that point. The Blockade Runner is bulky.
Yeah.
With its big hammerhead front end and its massive cluster of engines.
Mm-hmm.
But it's symmetrical. The Star Destroyer is colossal.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still kind of with that wedge shape invokes sort of the idea of a battleship.
Yeah, you know, or something you just want to put whipped cream on top of and eat.
Absolutely, or you know, you want it to have like a bunch of holes in it, like a big slice of Swiss cheese.
Yeah, exactly.
And I had not thought about the pie aspect before. It looks like a big slice of pie with a giant whipped cream and an olive on top. What are you obsessed with olives?
Olive? I think you mean cherry, perhaps.
Well, no, that was the thing, was the description of the Millennium Falcon. Flying hamburger with like an olive.
You mean like an olive shaker, like the little martini shaker?
Idea was sort of like if you took the olive with a toothpick and instead of putting it on top of the burger, you put it on the side of the burger.
See, I always thought of it as a hamburger, and then the thing on the cockpit on the side, I always thought of it like a martini shaker. And because people would say the olive, and I kept thinking like martinis and olives.
Okay, because it is sort of shaker-shaped.
Yeah, yeah.
If you turn on its side. But, you know, you get this ship that has symmetry.
Yeah.
But then you have this asymmetrical cockpit.
Yeah.
Which begs the question, why would you put your cockpit off-center like that? And I think really what's neat about that design is it says you don't have to have that symmetry. You can put the cockpit anywhere because you're flying, you know, it's like airplane. They're on instruments. You know.
Come on.
But, you know, you doesn't matter because you're not having to worry about what you see in front of you so much as what is on the display panel in the ships.
Is Julie Haggerty, is that the actress in Airplane?
That is indeed, yes.
Yeah, isn't there a deleted scene where Julie Haggerty is dressed as Ula in
Airplane? Well, there's an Inflato Han.
Inflato?
This is now the home of Inflato Han.
Yeah, hashtag Inflato Han.
Hashtag Inflato Han.
That's our this hashtag right now.
That's right. So we want to see that start to trend here. Inflato Han.
We had Leo's Honey Buns on the live show.
That's
now
right.
We have Inflato Han. My hashtag just keeps getting dirtier.
I know. It's strange how that happens.
But, Lando's Merkins and Leia licked the wall. They're all just like, they're dirty. This is such a dirty show.
It's a dirty, dirty show.
Well, it's a dirty universe. What do you expect?
Yeah, I guess so. You know, it's more lived in when it's dirty.
Exactly.
But I think that's what's unique about that ship is you have, and the fact that, you know, when you first see it,
yeah,
it's like, wow, that's pretty cool. Look how, you know, this is massive thing mm-hmm. here on the set. And then Luke's like, what a piece of junk. Like, how could you tell? It looks pretty good to me.
Looks spoiled little rich kid.
Yeah, don't be so negative.
Apparently moisture farmers make a lot more money than we thought because, you know, Luke is used to the high life
here.
Your
fancy little sky hopper that we'll talk about on the next episode. Uh-huh. But, you know, it was, and it's meant to be this thing that's just sort of cobbled together and you don't realize that that's the case except in the context of Luke declaring it a piece of junk and then later Lando referring to it as the fastest hunk of junk in the galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
And
does he call it a piece of, does he call it a hunk of junk?
He calls it the fastest hunk of junk in the galaxy. So you get this sort of acknowledgement that, you know, Lando and Han are in on the joke, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is, it's a piece of garbage, but, you know, that's kind
of
how I like it. Yeah.
Garbage, yeah.
This is our hill. These are our beans.
Yeah. Beans. Well, you know what was always cool to me as a kid? And keep in mind, when I got introduced to Star Wars, it was 77, 78. And so it was that era.
Yeah.
Right? And so what always fascinated me is it reminded me of my Uncle Jerry's van. And being in the late 70s even, his van was a type that when you got into it, it had the captain's chairs in the back, it had the bar, it had the bed, it had the, you know, all the fix-ins were, you know, where it was, and to me as a kid, thought
so, just something like right out of Crash and Bernie in Cartoons magazine.
Yeah, yeah, it was always like, I was thinking to myself, oh my gosh, this is like an apartment on wheels to, you know, to a little kid. And so to me, that's what made the Millennium Falcon so cool. It was like my Uncle Jerry's van.
I hadn't thought about that, but it really is like a custom Good Times van. You almost expect
yes,
it to be a portal in the shape of a diamond or something.
It's like, I thought to myself, you could live on the Millennium Falcon, and that was like the party bus almost.
Yeah.
Like it had that cool little lounge area where you could practice with your lightsaber, or had the stowaway compartments to a kid, that's perfect for hide and seek, you know.
Absolutely.
And, you know, everything about the Millennium Falcon was cool in that respect, that it was like,
the only thing that was missing was like carpet on the dash.
Yes, carpet, yeah, exactly.
You know, that was, had they had that, it would have been the whole thing. But that's interesting, because I never really thought about that, but it is, it's kind of like a custom van or almost like in a way Spaceballs kind of recognizes this by giving Lone Star the Winnebago
based
ship. It literally is like, you know, Han and Chewie are like this old couple who've retired and are driving around going to
like,
flea markets. And
they're BJ and the Bear.
Yes, exactly.
They're BJ and the Bear.
Oh, wow. Wow. You know, and the funny thing is, I remember an episode of BJ and the Bear where he was like hauling some sort of contraband and had to dump it.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Some big fat guy getting after him, and he said, "You know, you think I had a choice?" And then the little monkey was throwing dung or something. But you know, it digressed from there. I also want to point out there was probably earlier one person in the entire world mm-hmm. who actually snickered when I mentioned Cartoons magazine.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
And Crass and Bernie.
You're talking to someone who goes to the Autorama yearly. Oh, I always look at the cartoons, back issues, vintage issues. But you know what? A lot of people don't know that before they, when they were doing early casting, the role of Han Solo and Jabba were actually going to go to Burt Reynolds and Jackie Gleason. But then that didn't work out, you know. Yeah, it's Sally.
And then they were even talking about maybe using Paul Williams and that other guy from is his brother. Is instead of having like one hot, that would be like a pair.
No.
Han would have to go get like a big load of spice from some backwater planet that no one ever goes to.
Yeah, well,
and Vader be in hot pursuit.
See, George Lucas felt bad for passing them over, so he used them later on to operate the Jabba puppets.
Oh, of course,
And you can guess which one was at which end.
Exactly. So that was Paul Williams all that time.
Yes.
I thought it was Mike Edmonds. It turned out it was Paul Williams. Who also, he wrote Lofty Neck for... he wrote the song for Jabba's Palace, because he was a songwriter as well. So you have, throughout, you get the Falcon, and then you get the TIE fighters, mm-hmm. and then later the X-Wing and Y-Wing fighters. Mm-hmm. And then if that isn't enough, you then get a special TIE fighter. Mm-hmm. Because Darth Vader's special. He's going to have a special TIE fighter. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they call it the TIE Advance, but no one ever made another one. Did you notice that?
They dare not, because Vader wanted to be the only kid on the block with one.
Yeah, I'm surprised it wasn't yellow the way he was when he was Anakin. Everything had to be yellow.
That is why in Episode 3, Anakin's starfighter is yellow. Yeah. And it's got that... I love how they use on his starfighter, it has that TIE fighter cockpit, look,
Yeah.
Is that early version, you could tell, of what would be the TIE fighter.
Yeah, in fact, as we work toward the prequels, that's something I want to talk about, is the fact that one of the saving graces in that. Mm-hmm. But, for me, one of the things, the Falcon's really cool, but I loved the Rebel Blockade Runner, as it was known then, the Tantive IV, as it would become known. I just thought that was the coolest thing in the world. And it becomes even cooler in that was the Millennium Falcon.
Mm-hmm.
That it originally...
Oh, yeah!
The Hammerhead cockpit was replaced, or actually replaced the original cockpit, which looked like the actual final Falcon's cockpit, only it was parked right at the front. And what they did was, there are some, escape pods or something along one side, right behind the gun emplacements.
Yeah.
Amidships that were originally gun emplacements when it was the Falcon, and to establish a larger scale, they just sort of retooled some aspects and made the cockpit look like, the window area would be tinier. When it was decided that look wasn't right, Lucas wanted something unique. So that very nearly, when you look at the Rebel ship there, the Tantive IV, that very nearly would have been the Falcon. And then if you try to extrapolate from that and imagine how much different things like the asteroid field and the second Death Star might have been.
Mm-hmm.
And would those elements have even come in with a less sleek ship?
Yeah.
And so, you really paid a great service by the fact that Lucas said, no, let's do something completely different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's true. And, this is still related to the Millennium Falcon, but did you ever see that unproduced prototype of that vehicle that apparently is built to fit between the two?
Oh, yes. So the toy that was made to fit inside the little...
what would you call those? Those little, it's almost like he's got a gap in his two front teeth, the Millennium Falcon.
I always looked at it sort of like manta ray style. Like those little flaps of skin at the front of a manta ray's face.
Yeah, uh-huh.
It always put me in the mind of that sort of thing.
So this unproduced Kenner prototype toy, I guess it was like the missing tooth on his smile, I guess.
Oh, I see. It was just kind of like, got some of those dental implants or something. Like a partial.
Yeah, I'm not... yeah. I'm not sure what that vehicle was meant for. Maybe that's why they scrapped the whole idea, because it didn't make any sense why they needed something like that. But
yeah, it seemed like, I think that the concept was that that would be like the ship you would go and like pick stuff up and then drive it up to the Falcon and plug in and unload and go back and get more stuff.
Okay.
Something along those lines. That's the only thing I can really think of.
Uh-oh,
and yeah. An interesting thing when you're talking about the various ships of Star Wars is one that you don't, a lot of people don't realize is technically doubles as a ship because it is mobile.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the Death Star.
Yeah, yeah.
The Death Star was designed to be a space station that you could drive around in, as it were. Apparently, once you get close to your target, you have to put it in a very low gear. I don't know, maybe there was a school zone around Yavin 4.
Mm-hmm.
But you'll notice that they, you know, you have to think they must have been damn close to Yavin at the rate of speed that thing moves.
Oh, yeah.
Like, oh, well, this worked out real well, Lord Vader. We're practically there.
Or maybe the Death Star just being driven by a senior citizen from Florida or something.
Oh, could be, yeah. It's like Revenge of the Nerds. Got the old cruise control set on 35. Or maybe it was Tarkin. You know, he's an old fella.
He is. He is an old geezer.
Can we go any faster? No, Lord Vader. We know. Safety first.
See, every time I said this on the live show, every time you do Vader's impression, you always sound like Jack Palance as Vader. Just that little bitty bit you just gave us.
Can we go any faster?
Not that I'm any better at impressions.
I know. I just,
definitely not.
It's not one of my best, to say the least.
It's definitely not your Sling Blade.
No, yeah, definitely not. But that's an interesting aspect of the Death Star, is that it is a mobile platform.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
very
sure.
A slow-moving mobile platform. And has no apparent visible engines. You know, you never saw any, like with the Star Destroyers, you don't see anything blazing away there, moving it through space.
Well, here's the thing about that. It's either powered by two things. One, it's either like a big hamster ball, and you have a rancor inside just kind of running constantly.
And I want to applaud you for actually saying rancor in the first time.
I had to really, really think about it. Really think about it before that word slipped out of my mouth. But the other thing is, they thought that they were just killing off all these Bothans, but in reality, they were capturing them, and they're all on these bicycles inside the Death Star, powering it away.
Okay.
Cycling away, and that's what's making the Death Star, you know, powered up.
So it's a Schwinn engine.
Yes.
Schwinn engine.
It's Schwinn powered by the Schwartz.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
I went there.
Yeah, you did go there. All right.
Let's get away from there now.
Yeah. So how do you, going into your sequel, because you have all these amazing fighter craft and capital ships,
mm-hmm.
and as you go into The Empire Strikes Back, then it, you know, is there any way to one-up the beginning of episode four of New Hope? Well, of course there is. You get like a crap ton of Star Destroyers,
mm-hmm.
which you've already established is like bigger than anything out there. And then you say, oh, by the way, what if we took that and built something five times as big around it? And then you get the Vader's giant-ass Star Destroyer.
And that one is that's the Imperium class one, right?
I believe that is right. I believe that is the Imperium.
Yeah, because I think if you're judging, you know, by
not to be
the,
confused with the Emporium class, which
is basically
like a big mall in space.
Yeah, Emporium class. Yeah, I'm not sure we got New Hope, whether if it's the Victory or the Imperial class, but either way, when you see the one in Empire Strikes Back, if you go by the reference books, it's somewhere in the vicinity of 4 to 5 times bigger than the next biggest.
Well, roughly, if you look at the command tower,
yeah,
on a regular Star Destroyer, Vader's Star Destroyer's command tower is roughly the same size.
Mm-hmm.
So it is literally like if you took a regular Star Destroyer and then built a bigger Star Destroyer around it. Mm-hmm, and just stacked more crap on top of it and made it bigger and longer, and apparently has to have big-ass red engines because the little blue ones just wouldn't cut it.
Oh, no. Exactly. And that's a good point that you bring up, like the tower part of the Star Destroyers. You know, with the exception, you know, once you get into Jedi, you have the Executor class, which has no tower, which I thought was funny. But when you get into the ones with the towers, it's almost like how we are with our architecture in America. Here we are building these big skyscrapers, and we're thinking we're being all fancy with the designs and the size and what have you. And then you go to, like, where is it, in Japan or somewhere, where they have these skyscrapers that are like works of art that design-wise and size-wise just blow our skyscrapers away, it seems like.
Absolutely.
So, New Hope... Star Destroyers are like the American version, and then you have the Empire ones, which would be the foreign version, I guess. But yeah, it's so funny because then you get into an even bigger Star Destroyer with Jedi, the Executor class, which once you get to that one, you're just thinking, good night! How much bigger can it get? And you don't really... You get the sense of it's just massively bigger that it could swallow like 20 Star Destroyers itself. But when you start, if you're going to be as big of a nerd as me and start looking through the reference books and you see, you know, the side view of comparison of Star Destroyers, it's amazing how much bigger it is.
Yes.
How much more massive it is than the next few sizes down. With the exception of the Eclipse class, which is the big, you know, black one, and I guess that's like E or something, I suppose, stuff, which we're probably not going to get into.
Yeah, well, what's interesting is, you know, that it really underscores a lot of what goes on with the Empire, and I think we may have talked about this in the past, or I certainly have in the Jedi Justifications, is that the Empire likes big, scary things.
Mm-hmm.
And will continue to build bigger and scarier things because it's very intimidating.
If you
come hoving in this giant spacecraft that's longer than, you know, it's five times as big as the last big thing you made.
That's a good point, and that's what they built all of Dark Empire around as far as like their vehicles, because in Dark Empire you had the World Devastators.
Yes.
And the World Devastators are just these massive... It's almost like if you took, like, two ginormous Borg ships and Borg cubes and just, like, shoved them together with these big engines on the bottom and this connecting thing in between. It's just these Devastators, and the way they're illustrated in Dark Empire... I guess it was Cam Kennedy was the artist, I believe. I could be wrong on that one.
That sounds familiar. We're not going to bother to check.
Yeah, we never do. But let's just go with Cam Kennedy. Whoever they picked as the artist, they couldn't have picked a better person, because the way he illustrated these World Devastators, he just really captured the big, massive bulkiness of what they were.
You have that presence.
Yeah.
That, if you will, that is vital to making these things just look intimidating.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
Ultimately, that's what it's really all about, is intimidation.
Yeah, yeah.
These things are wildly impractical.
Mm-hmm.
But then that's true, and when we talk, especially when we get to talking about the terrestrial vehicles, there's a lot of wildly impractical there.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So with Empire, what's interesting is there's one little spaceship that has, you know, precious little bearing on the story, and it's almost glossed over. It's like, you know, it could be anything. You see it at such a distance, it's very nondescript, and that's the shuttle that's used to travel from Star Destroyer to Star Destroyer that would, in the special edition, get replaced by the much cooler Return of the Jedi Imperial shuttle model.
Yeah.
It's like they didn't matter, you know, the shuttle wasn't integral to the story, so they didn't bother. They just sort of glossed over and just, you know, here's a little box, the shoebox that the guy's going to fly over in. Who cares? and we move on. And so, you know, one of the few things the special edition did right was to give you that new and improved design. To replace the shoebox.
The shoebox. It's almost like those little box droids that are in the Death Star, except bigger.
Yeah, it just, you know, instead of wheels, it just has little rockets on it.
So I guess those little droids in the Death Star are like Roombas or something. They're just vacuuming in the Death Star.
Well, it gets dusty in there.
Yeah, a lot of space dust and debris.
Darth Vader has enough trouble as it is.
That's true.
Had a lot of dust collecting, you know. It just
his
gets
asthma's
more
a killer, you can
tell. Yeah, it gets more and more awkward. But, you know, there's some interesting things that you see with, like, the Star Destroyers, and talk about, you know, being wildly impractical. It's heavily underscored in both New Hope and The Empire Strikes Back. In A New Hope, where Han is confronted with several of them, and he's just sort of flitting about. Because they're so big, they're, you know, like firing a Tommy gun. Or, you know, the Thompson submachine gun's a really kick-ass looking gun. But its recoil is so bad, you're lucky if you hit anything. They literally were known as the spray and pray type of weapon that you spray a lot of bullets and pray they hit something.
I've never heard of them referred to that way. That's interesting, but that makes sense.
And so, and then even more so in The Empire Strikes Back, when you get a couple of them getting a little too close, you know, you got a couple of really overzealous captains trying to be the one to capture the Falcon, and then they're doing as they call in NASCAR, trade and paint.
Yeah. Which I always thought was, I know they probably didn't mean this, but that one scene in Galaxy Quest where they're pulling out for the first time of that space dock.
Yes.
And they're scraping the edge of it because he's still getting used to having to control it.
What I like of...
I always think of that part in Empire where the Star Destroyers get a little bit too close for comfort.
Yeah, I always thought of that as sort of like a combination of that and the long drawn out Star Trek.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Departure scene.
So. Oh man. Yeah, I wouldn't even have thought of the little box shuttle, but yeah.
Yeah, it just the box shuttle always bothered me, and I felt a little vindicated with that. And also, you get some curious ships like the Rebel transports in Empire, that the sardine ships, as I would call them, back in the day. And it wasn't until I saw some, you know, better imagery of them and some reproductions of them that I realized how truly unique those were, and because it's supposed to just be this thing you put a bunch of transport modules in, and it just kind of always has like these little wing sections that sort of cradle and cover that, you know, all of your cargo.
That was such a cool toy. I didn't have very many of the bigger vehicles as a kid. But that was one we did have because we came across it at a garage sale.
Ah.
And that was such a cool vehicle because opening it up, and I always thought it was funny that the little handle that you twist and open it up, it almost had the same design as the ship itself, but it was, you know, micro. So you turn that and you pull the top off, and what was so cool is you could fit all of your figures in there.
Yeah, because it was designed to double as a carrying case.
Yeah, and I thought that was awesome that they designed it that way. Yeah, so as a kid, that was a big deal to have that. That was the only time that, you know, your Rebels got along with the Imperials, because they all had to live together. It was almost like the Odd Couple, but more intense.
Yeah, and there were some deaths involved.
Yeah. Felix Unger didn't make it very long in there.
Yeah, he was found murdered in his cabin.
Dengar was the Oscar Madison of the bounty hunters, and he just didn't take well to him. And yeah, they, you know, Greedo was actually the Felix Unger of the bounty hunters. So that's what I should. Felix and Oscar as played by Greedo and Dengar. I want to see that.
Well, that's it. We'll have to do that on the live show sometime. We can do a melodrama theater.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe I could drop some visuals and we can add in the audio as we go along.
There we go. That'd be perfect.
It'd be like those for those of you who remember, I'm sure they still use them in Sunday school when they would retell the Bible stories, and they would have the little felt characters that they would stick to the felt board.
Oh, wow.
That's what we should do.
Yeah,
we should
make some little felt bounty hunters.
We should do that and recreate the Odd Couple. But, it has nothing to do with starships,
that's right.
Okay.
But, you know, what's interesting about it is you see the progression from your regular Star Destroyer to your Super Star Destroyer. And by Jedi, you're also starting to get things like the TIE Interceptor, which is sort of taking the concept of Vader's TIE Fighter as that sort of being the prototype. And it is sort of the Highlander of TIE Fighters, because there can be only one. And then you get the TIE Interceptor, which takes that kind of splayed wing idea and throws you a few extra guns out on the wing. The guys driving the regular TIE Fighters like, hey, you have a little extra guns for us.
Yeah, it was like the Mad Max version of the TIE Fighter almost, because it just was that little bit more deadlier than all the others.
That's so true. And the neat thing is that, you know, the TIE Fighter was just such an efficient little thing. It's just this tiny little ball with these gigantic wings. And it's the most impractical, impossible-looking thing. And I think that's, again, what is one of the strengths, is it takes these this idea of, you know, in space you can drive around in a giant H. You know, like the Star Wars is brought to you by the letter H. And it works. And then by Empire, where you illustrate that you can actually take those down onto a planetary level and fly them around in the atmosphere, then you're like, whoa, hey, how does that work? But again, we'll refer you to the Jedi justifications on that.
But you know, as a kid, those TIE Fighters were the easiest things to draw in the world.
That's so true, because if you knew how to spell, you're halfway there.
That's how I learned my ABCs, by Star Wars. You know, just... anyways. You know what we kind of... Oh, you know what? We didn't talk about the TIE Bomber.
Oh, that's right, yes. Because
those came out in Empire.
That was even beforehand. So, you did have that exact kind of wing with a double... kind of like a cockpit and a cargo area to carry all your little bombs around in. And that was a neat little thing, too. Just the idea of, like, dropping... you know, individual charges.
Yeah.
Hopefully, you know, collapse caves or... That's the only thing I could figure is they're imagining they found a hole in the asteroid big enough to hide in, so they're hoping to collapse the asteroid with the bombs.
You know what I like to think is when they're not using them as bombers, TIE Fighter pilots are using them the way truckers use our cabs, where it has like the little bed.
Oh,
at the
like
back.
A sleeper, yeah.
Yeah, they just, when they're not traveling,
so
you know.
It's a long haul TIE Fighter pilot.
Yeah, long haul, and you just pull over to the edge, and you know, and you just slip over into that little compartment area where he has his nice little bed fixed up. He's got a little black and white TV set up.
When you stop at the Imperium, or the Emporium class Star Destroyer, which is like a Stuckey's.
Yeah, you go to the Imperial Emporium.
Yeah, you can wash your TIE Fighter and get a shower, maybe a nice hot meal, and some mud flaps or whatever doubles as mud flaps for those things.
Get some trail mix so you can, you know, snack on the...
That's
on...
right.
get yourself a nice hot steaming bowl of Wookiee floor soup while you're at it.
Oh, wow, that's some good stuff there.
Not sure about good, but it's stuff. We'll leave it at that.
So with the Rebels, you really don't see anything new by Empire, because Luke has this. You see a lot of X-wings in play. You know, Luke's isn't the only X-wing departing the base on the Hoth, and so by Jedi they want to punch it up a little bit and suggest that the Rebels have a couple of new vehicles. And they have the very sleek A-wing fighter and the very curiously awkward B-wing fighter, which would have been useless against the Death Star flying down the trenches.
I never, as a kid, never got the B-wing. It never appealed to me. I never liked it. It didn't make sense. I just did not get it. Now, the A-wing, I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah, the A-wing is neat because it it's just like a sleek. It's like the Cooper Minis in was it the Italian Job or?
You do realize Coopers exist outside of that movie, correct?
Oh, I didn't realize that. I thought they invented that for like those cars in that Michael Keaton movie, Gung Ho.
Oh my god. Oh my gosh, that's so epic that we actually reference Gung Ho on this show.
I know. Again, there's probably two people in the world kind of giving a little chuckle. Oh, Gung Ho, I love that movie. I want to buy this car. But
wow.
But you get that very sleek, fast moving, apparently once kamikaze type of fighter.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the B-Wings were just a very awkward, you know, the Fantastic Four's pogo plane made more sense than the B-Wing in some respects.
Yeah.
I like the fact that it's so ridiculously unique, and I think in the expanded universe or the backstory, that was supposedly designed by Admiral Akbar.
That's correct.
And I think that was solely to answer that very concern, like, how, you know, why would you even have this? Obviously, the head guy designed it. Perfect. Good work, Admiral. We love it. We'll go right into production. Well, you know, it was made by a Rick McCallum-style yes man.
Yeah, exactly. Well, is Akbar, is his species, are they water dwellers for the most part? Or am I just thinking that because they look like lobsters?
They look like lobster fish. And because they've got like the fish face and they've got the Popeye arms made of lobster meat.
Yeah.
Or lobster shells.
Yum.
Amen. And they also have this inherent fear of drawn butter. But
wow. But does that species, are they aquatic in any way?
I think, you know, in the expanded universe, they were very much aquatic.
Okay, well then the B-Wing would make more sense underwater than space. I don't know why. It just seems like more of like an underwater kind of faring vehicle.
Yeah, I could see that.
Just because of the awkward fins, I guess, if you want to call those fins. I don't know.
Well, it seems like you've got this rotating cockpit on this awkwardly long arm that doesn't really have a lot of practicality to it, but then that's so true of a lot of things. But let's go ahead, as we're running low on time, move on into the prequels, and oftentimes they get the short shrift anyway.
Oh, but you know what we did, just real quick, what we missed in the original trilogy? We missed two that I'd want to touch on.
Oh,
one,
absolutely.
And they can be quick ones. The cloud cars. Are those?
They will actually be on our next episode.
Those aren't interstellar. Okay.
You can't drive them in space.
Okay, well, this next one is definitely interstellar, and that's the Slave One.
Yes, I kept thinking, you know, Slave One kept coming to mind, then it wouldn't.
Yeah.
Well,
that's
Slave
how
One is.
That's how Boba Fett wants you to handle it.
Yeah, that's so true.
Don't think of it too long. But, I gotta ask, maybe there's an obvious backstory or anything, but why is it called the Slave One? Now, I've heard tell that originally, the backstory to Boba Fett was that he was supposed to have grown up a slave, and obviously the prequels nixed that idea completely.
You know, I've never really heard anything other than the obvious derivative computer term.
Yeah?
Which is like I've seen the actual term used in computing or computers, the hardware of certain drives being like a slave one and slave two drive.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what any of that means.
I have seen
the term used, so that's the extent of my knowledge. Please, please do not write in and ask me to do tech support.
And maybe I was thinking that the story of Boba, the backstory was supposed to be that he grew up as a slave. Maybe that came from episode one because Annie, why did I say Annie? Anakin.
Why did you say Annie?
I hate the fact that they call him Annie. I don't know why I said that. But I guess Qui-Gon would be
I think because he originally the costume design was supposed to be a red dress with a white frill.
Oh, is that
And he was supposed to have no pupils.
That makes more sense.
And
that,
a dog.
For some reason, it makes complete sense for some reason. But they apparently that the backstory was going to be that Boba Fett was also a slave and he worked his way out of slavery to grow up to become this wonderful bounty hunter, but obviously that didn't happen.
Yeah.
But the slave one is cool, and this is another thing that came out of, crap. It was either Shadows of the Empire, or it could have been Dark Empire. I think it was Dark Empire, or Heir to the Empire, one of those empires. It's part of the Empire family, I know that. It's, the Slave One is, he's got it so well tuned that when he took off from whatever port station, whatever he was leaving, the Slave One told him in his helmet, not out loud in the cockpit, but his helmet told him that the, Slave One was heavier by something like 5.2 ounces or pounds or something. So that's how Boba Fett knew someone had placed either a homing device or a bomb on there. Cause that,
it was of course,
that much heavier. And so he was able to, you know, avoid being either.
That would probably get tiresome after a while. Like, what if you track some mud in on your boots? And it's like nagging. Yeah. Oh, by the way, I'm .00008 pounds too heavy. Like, shut up.
Or he had an extra helping.
A big meal, yeah.
Extra helping of Wookiee floor soup.
I know, like, it's irresistible.
Or he had some bantha ribs.
I mean, if you knew how it was made, you'd never touch it, but. Once you've had it, though, it's just, you can't stop eating it. You're like, it's like eating the calf fries in Funny Farm.
Funny Farm now, huh?
You never know what I will reference next.
Two awesome 80s comedies in one, references in one show. Wow.
I'll tell you.
Yeah.
I love me some calf fries. But, and that's a good point. Slave One is one of the iconic ships, designed apparently from the local street lamps in Marin County. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, they thought that would make a good ship design. It's perhaps one of the most awkward looking ships, but it grows on you so perfectly that, and the fact that, you know, it has that unique way of sort of, you know, flying one way but landing almost on its back, as it were. Which, again, adds to the uniqueness and the idea that, you know, the design, from the design standpoint, nobody's ever beholden to terrestrial constraints. If you can land, you know, even if you can make planet fall, you don't really muck about with things like that.
And, you know, that's actually a good way to segue into the prequels, because you lose that in the prequels, because is it Doug Chang that designed the
ships? A lot
ships?
Of the ships, yeah.
He took it more in a practical sense. A lot of the prequel ships make sense because they have more of an aerodynamic, sleek look. They have a lot more, they're a lot more symmetrical, a lot of wings, a lot of this, equal turbo engines on either side, so that way.
Yeah, and a lot of it almost modifying actual.
Yeah.
Types of craft, like.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
And the like. And yeah, you do like with the Naboo Starfighter, very sleek, very, it almost is like taking Star Wars on the edge of Buck Rogers or Flash Gordon. You just like right at the edge of the old movie serial rocket ships.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it's sort of like if you took a Flash Gordon rocket ship and mated it with a horseshoe crab, you would get the Naboo Starfighter.
Yeah. Exactly.
And you get, but at the same time, you do get some really curious ships, like the Trade Federation, you know, Tickle Me Death Star, that has the kind of the big C-shaped arms surrounding a central spherical control station.
The floating bagel, I like to call it.
Yes, with a bite out of it.
Well, someone was hungry.
Because what's curious about that is you have your landing bays on either side of the cusp of the sea.
Yeah.
So you literally have to like drive toward it, face forward, and then you have to make a quick turn.
Mm-hmm.
It's like one of those really awkward driveways that some people have, you know, where you come in at an angle, all of a sudden you have to make a sharp turn. And like,
yes.
Who designed this thing? Jeez. Obviously someone who doesn't drive.
Exactly. Well, Lot Dodd was very particular on when he's the one that sanctioned the plans for that. And Lot Dodd was very specific. He said, I don't really care how you do it, just make it wizard. Make it very wizard.
You would expect that to be very wizard.
Yeah.
So you do what I do like about, and this is what I was hinting at earlier, one of the, there are more than one, but I mean, if you had to narrow it down to one redeeming quality about the prequels, I would argue that there was a thought process that went into a progression that a lot of the vehicles you see are literally like the precursors or the prototypes. If you were to look at, say, the Model T Ford versus a modern Ford,
mm-hmm.
you can see a progression.
Yeah.
And you do see a lot of that. The Naboo Starfighter seems a bit of a stretch, but it takes you toward the X-Wing in a way.
Yeah.
Almost toward the X-Wing and the Y-Wing simultaneously. The core design of the droid starfighters, which aren't technically ships, but they're still spacefaring, do sort of put you in the mind of the TIE fighter. It's sort of like, oh, that would be a good idea for the TIE fighter, and then by episode 3, you've taken the Jedi starfighter to that very point.
I can kind of see that about the droid starfighters, but when I saw the Sith Infiltrator, immediately I went to TIE Interceptor.
Yes, it is sort of a TIE Interceptor with a giant snout.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So yeah, the Sith Infiltrator, you saw the early workings of what would be like the TIE Interceptor or TIE Fighter. And of course it's got that nifty speeder bike, but again, that'll be in part 2 of this series because
absolutely. And then you have, as you're going into, say, episode 2 and 3, you've got your wedge-shaped Jedi Starfighter that's then later replaced by the super compact, much more marketable for toy manufacturers version.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of like the smart car
of the
Starfighters, because you look at that thing and I wouldn't get in that thing.
Well, the Starfighter, to me, when I first saw it, it kind of invoked memories of the A-Wing, because they had that.
Yeah, the original, the wedge-shaped Starfighter from episode 2 really gives you that A-Wing feel.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can see a practical maneuver, a practical progression from that to the A-Wing.
Yeah.
It's almost as if the A-Wings were made from components of the old Jedi Starfighter somebody found.
Well, it's like the Jedi Starfighter had that one-eyed stand with the Cooper, and they produced the A-Wing.
Oh, there was that. Yeah, that was awkward.
It was very awkward.
We weren't supposed to speak of that ever again.
Yeah.
And
it was only made possible because of all the oil lubrication.
And the moist side of the Force.
Zing!
Hello!
But wow.
That's one of the things I do like, is if you look at the Jedi Starfighters we mentioned earlier, the Episode 3 Jedi Starfighter, you do see sort of the progression toward the TIE Fighter.
Mm-hmm.
Especially with the cockpit design. And what I loved about the Jedi Starfighters in 2 and 3 was the hyperspace ring.
Yeah.
That was just such a kick-ass concept.
That made a lot of sense to me. When I saw that, I thought, wow, I get it now.
Because what that allows you to have is a starfighter that isn't bogged down with whatever you need with a hyperdrive.
Mm-hmm.
You just have it separate and then apparently just abandon it. You just sort of park it in space and hope it's still there when you get back. You know, in case space jaw was going, oh, look.
I was about to go there. Wow. I was about to go there. That's so funny.
And I also like the fact that they gave you a little bit different hyperspace ring between the two films.
Mm-hmm.
And that just was such a cool, conceptually, that was a really cool little thing. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you have those arc I believe it's like ARC 170 starfighters that the clones drive around in. Mm-hmm. You know, and you're also treated almost like to bookend the trilogies. Mm-hmm. Your opening sequence to episode 3 is ridiculously dynamic. It's like, let's one up the final battle from Jedi.
Mm-hmm.
And what I loved about that, though, was you had, they're trying to figure out what all these ships are.
Yeah.
You have the familiar and the unfamiliar. You've got, Grievous's flagship. And then ships that look like they're lesser versions thereof. And then you've got your newer versions of your Republic battlecruisers.
Mm-hmm.
That are, you can see a progression between the episode 2 and 3 and then on to the Star Destroyer.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got your, and you've got these ARC starfighters with their tandem pilots and a gunner.
Mm-hmm.
And there you're really kind of invoking, you're kind of going back to where, you know, Lucas was having the ILM look at World War II movies.
Yes.
And dogfights and stuff. And so you have a bit of that where you have your larger scale, like your fighter bomber type ship. And then one of the things I really loved was the idea of having two capital ships going abreast and just firing into one another amidships. Like old naval battles.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was a cool touch. Yes, the side-by-side.
Yes.
Firing at one another. You know, you're talking about the ARC 170 Starfighter, I remember when I saw the design, you know, that, like you were saying, that top part is reminiscent of the World War II type fighters. When I saw that, and it had the gun turn in the back and, like, more of like the bubble-looking cockpits, you know, front and back and down through the middle, it immediately went to the flying wing in Raiders of the Lost Ark, because I'm such Indiana Jones nut. I thought that top image really invoked that design of that vehicle, because So I don't know if that was on purpose or what, but you had the opposite end cockpits with the interconnecting thing between the two. The machine gun in the back. You know, you almost imagine Marion in the back firing away.
Exactly.
So I thought that was a nice little nod on top of the fact that it invoked the X-wing design with the pop-open wings.
Precisely. And then you also had the and it also invoked an unproduced, you'd spoken earlier about like unproduced prototype toys. There was actually a design put forth by Kenner back in the day of a tandem cockpit X-Wing.
Yes, I'm glad. I was going to bring that up. I'm glad you did, because I was going to bring that up if you didn't.
And it's almost like you have to feel like that's part of what inspired this. Like,
let's give
kids their tandem X-Wing.
I would love it if you could find that for flavor art, but I looked for a while to find that. I couldn't find it, but maybe you'll have better luck than I will.
Yeah, I'll have to see if I can find that. It's highly unlikely, but you never know.
Then, I remember seeing, that was one of the images I remember seeing like in an old Star Wars Insider. Couldn't find it before tonight to reference it, but
saw the same magazine or the same articles or what have you. You had some other, various droid fighter ships and such. You had, Grievous's ship in Episode 3, which gets very brief coverage. Hot rod looking thing. I'm not really sure what we're meant to come away from that one with. And there's a lot of other little ships that just don't really make as big an impact, but,
What about a Dooku's thing with the big sails?
Oh, the solar sail! Yes, that was a curious thing.
That was curious is a good way to put it.
Yeah, I just can't help but think it took him about a month and a half to get to Coruscant. You feel like you would have found some place to ditch the damn thing.
I mean, that design belonged less in Star Wars and more in like Space Hunter Adventures in the Forbidden Zone or something.
Wow.
Which, by the way, is the movie that they stole Grievous's little bike thing from. Yeah, the wheel bike from...
Which was actually stolen from the very first motorcycle ever.
That's
built.
Right. We did talk about this.
And then I guess, you know, like, again, speaking of the progression of design, you have that ship that Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon arrive in that is very reminiscent of the Tamiya
mm-hmm.
IV.
Mm-hmm.
A very
yeah.
precursor type of vessel.
Yeah, yeah. Now, there is one thing that was very odd, and it was only put out there by Kenner, during their Power of the Force line. And it was and probably not an interstellar ship, but I'll go ahead and bring it up now. It was the cruise missile trooper. Cole, do you remember this?
I don't know what that's meant to be, but yes, I know the cruise missile trooper. It literally is the love child of the Jedi Starfighter.
Yes.
And a clone trooper.
Yeah, because the figure wasn't even a figure. It was just like the little head.
It was sort of built in because
it was built in.
Some chest and some arms in there, but they were immobile.
I don't even think it was that. I think it literally is just the helmet and shoulder. It was almost
on the underside. I did actually have one back in the days when we were. I never bought one myself, but I got a loose one in a collection back when we were.
And you still don't? You don't have it still?
No, sadly, it's gone. But it actually had a chest and arms.
That's
you see, like when his arms were sort of like gripping something.
That's
and then when you deployed the helmet, you know, when you pulled the lever and the little head would stick out, the uh-huh. chest would actually move as well.
Yeah.
While he was pulling himself up, and it got a little creepy after a while.
Yeah, because the little helmet is basically like an...
It's almost like an AT-AT driver.
AT-AT driver, yeah. I couldn't think of it. AT-AT driver helmet. In a way. That's right, he would kind of pop up, almost like a little whack-a-mole.
Yes, you know, exactly. I guess really, you know, the only other space-faring vehicles of note, there was another I'd thought about that we didn't touch on. Oh, yes, was the Nubian!
You just wanted a way to work in your water
yeah,
impression.
That's right.
Which, oddly enough, also sounds like Jack Palance.
Pretty much all of my impressions sound like Jack Palance. Jack Palance's Watto. Oh, Jack, you are my number one guy. Mm.
Oh, man. That's wicked.
That you, Sugar Bombs?
Or should I say that's Wizard?
Oh, that is very Wizard.
Oh, man. Nubian.
So, the various Naboo Royal chrome spacecraft
mm-hmm.
that are just, you know, it's almost like they were a deliberate attempt to say, look what we can do with CG.
Mm-hmm.
We can give you something we couldn't give you practically, and that's an entire mirror ship.
Which got on the nerves of every person on Tatooine because those twin suns reflecting off of that ship, man, was blinding half of Tatooine at one time.
Yeah, a lot of people had to go and buy some special goggles, like welders type goggles,
mm-hmm,
for
mm-hmm.
the better part of the afternoon, which is their afternoon is about 17 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, that's where Fixer and Cammy, like their families, made their fortune off of goggles during that era, you know, because
okay.
a lot of goggles, because they thought when that happened, that incident happened, they thought it was going to be an ongoing thing, so they started mass producing goggles, and people were panicked, so they had to have the latest, you know.
Yeah, you don't have a goggle gap.
Yeah, goggle gap, that's it. That's exactly it.
So,
it
was, yeah, and ultimately, it was sort of a rags-to-riches-to-rags story. Like the
yeah, by the time we see them again in New Hope, their yeah. families are broke again. Cause
yeah, Fixers are writing checks for $1.09! But,
Nice.
I do like that because it did speak of, like, everything that came out of Naboo had to be overtly elegant.
Mm-hmm.
So it does have that quality, and I actually personally love the one with the four engines
mm-hmm.
from, I believe, Episode 2. That they arrive.
Yeah.
So Padme's decoy can get shot right off the bat.
Uh huh.
And I like that look because it sort of, again, it's almost like puts you in the mind of a flying wing.
It does. Always. It does, especially the way it kind of glides through space as it approaches Coruscant. Yeah, schmancy.
And speaking of gliding through space, that whole opening sequence in Episode 3, that's another thing I like, is that you sort of feel like you're just bouncing and bubbling through space there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're sort of like, here, oh, we're going to drop down about 5,000 feet. Now we're going to fly back up. And there's that just kind of that fluid motion
that sort of
said, okay, we are now at the height of our craft from Episode 4 to Episode 3.
But, I mean, nothing will beat the opening of A New Hope. Nothing.
No,
because that
set a precedent.
Revenge of the Sith is definitely... comes in second, because that is about the most impressive opening sequence you can have for a Star Wars movie aside from A New Hope, because for those very reasons that you just stated, you felt like you were there.
Yeah.
And man, pulled off so nicely.
And it was just the perfect way to bring you in to that universe.
You know, I know we're running short on time, but in Episode 2, the transports that bring in the clone troopers at the end, can we assume that those are interstellar? They would have to be, right?
Not necessarily. They could have been, like, brought in on something else.
That's true.
They seem more terrestrial because they've got the van doors on either side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they very much resemble, I mean, they invoke, like, the Huey helicopters, like, in Vietnam, where
you'd
see them land and they would open up.
Apocalypse Now. You got Dooku there. The horror! that was the least Palance-esque.
That was... No, your Watto was actually pretty spot on. I had to give it to you on the Watto one.
I was willing to buy into the Palance thing. But but also, and one of the other ships that occurs to me that kind of glossed over and forgot real quick, or a couple of things, is the Mon Calamari pickle ships which, you know, look like great big gunmetal pickles. They looked, you know, they weren't so much constructed as molded.
But that's the best they could do with their lobster hands.
Come on. Well, you know, it's hard to work when you, on ships like that if you don't have people hands. And then also...
That's for you listeners of Hey Kids Comics.
And then there was also that curious rebel vessel that was kind of... We kind of called it the Evinrud. And that is the what would be the medical frigate.
Oh, yes.
Which resembled a backward flying outboard motor.
Yes! That's true.
And it's, again, one of those really unique ships that, capital ships that plays a fairly important role.
That really is unique on the same level of Slave One, because it was such an unusual design.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. I can't believe I forgot about that one.
I know. It's one of my favorite designs, really, because it's kind of weird, but it really grew on me over time. And then, of course, you know, there's all kinds of vessels that the Trade Federation brought to bear.
Well, you know, we have to mention the most embarrassing of the interstellar ships, and that would have been the ship, I don't know what it's called, but I know what it looks like. And it appears at the very end of Episode 1, and it drops off Palpatine onto Naboo to meet with everybody. And
is it that kind of buggy-looking ship? Or?
Well, to me, it looks like it's anatomically correct, if you know what I mean.
Oh,
take another look.
Oh, yeah, I think I know which one you're... Yeah, yes. Because there was also a shuttle the Nemodians had, which was, like, bug-shaped.
No. This... When I first saw this on the screen at midnight at Episode 1 premiere, and that popped into the screen, I was like, really? Are we going to... Is that obvious that we have the two balls to the side? I'll leave it at that. But watch that scene again, and you'll see what I mean.
I'll have to check that out, because that one escapes me. And there was, like, I think the... You see briefly in Episode 3 the V-Wing fighters, and then a shuttle that Palpatine has. that puts you in the mind of the later Imperial shuttle, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. I do love the Imperial shuttle because it's one of the few ships that looks like it's very sleek and bright and not at all chunky like a lot of the other stuff is, and it almost kind of puts you in the mind of this was something that's sort of built outside of this isn't so much a Marshall type of thing like you have your Star Destroyers just bristling with guns and towers and stuff. This is one of those things that was just sort of, you know, it's like the really nice Cadillac that takes you to the battleship if you're like, you know.
I can't believe we almost ended the show without talking about the Sol Tidarium, because that was a pretty impressive thing to see in Jedi for the first time.
Yeah, it's got this, you know, ridiculous fin that doesn't seem to really serve any great purpose. And mm-hmm. I think I found the very ship you're talking about. the great,
did you know?
The Red Rocket, if you will. I may have to add a picture of that to
the... Yeah, not to be dirty, but that's the first thing that popped into mind. It just,
well, I hate
thought,
to disillusion you, though. Apparently it has three testicles.
Oh, okay.
So you well, definitely have a well, dirtier not, mind than most.
Well, no, it's got two testicles, but he needs to go to the doctor to get that third one checked out.
He probably should.
Well, on that, we should probably end the show.
Yes, indeed. There are probably a couple other little minor ships that got a brief shot here or there that we didn't mention. But for the most part, we really wanted to explore and celebrate just the diversity and the unique nature mm-hmm. of all of these interplanetary vessels. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was going to be apologetic to everything else that doesn't get coverage, mm-hmm. being all of your land vehicles and such like that. But thanks to my esteemed co-host, we will even get to see that.
Yeah, that's going to be a fun one, because in prepping for this show, I think 75% of my notes were ended up being, you know, land vehicles. And I thought, oh, crap, we're doing Interstellar. Well, at least I'm prepared for the next one.
Exactly. Yeah, you'll be on your game there. So, Eddie, thank you. And thank you to everybody who tunes in to us every couple of weeks or checks out the live show. And to everybody who's discovered us for the first time, we hope you really enjoy this. Obviously, we just love talking about the Star Wars.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And thank you to everyone who's sending feedback. It seems like I'm starting to get a little bit more feedback nowadays. Please definitely, Cole, where can they send feedback?
You can write to us, send us suggestions, feedback, anything you'd like to jcumail@yahoo.com. Mm-hmm. We'd love to hear from you. Check us out on Twitter. Every once in a while, I'll actually bother to tweet. So if mm-hmm. you don't like getting a lot of tweets, this is the Twitter feed for you. Mm-hmm. It's at the Jedi Cole U. And you can mm-hmm. find the Rancor Pit Jedi Cole Universe Star Wars podcast on Facebook. Mm-hmm. If you want to check us out there, as well as the Jedi Cole Universe itself on Facebook.
And again, anybody who has been sending feedback the other ways, you're more than welcome to keep sending them to my email, to my Instagram, and the Facebook page. Please do that. We've even gotten a little bit of feedback. Well, I'll need to share this with you later. We've gotten some feedback on our little chat board on the Deep Ellum On Air website.
Oh,
so
very nice.
You can definitely leave us feedback, hopefully during the live show.
Which also reminds me, if you want to check out the live show when it's live, it's every other Sunday. So if you're... on Sundays where we have the pre-recorded show pop up, check out the next Sunday, deepellumonair.com.
Definitely.
11 a.m. to 12 p.m., Eddie and I in the studio most weeks, one or both of us at all times on board, and check out the Rancor Pit Live. And Eddie, where can we find your art?
I'm about to rehaul my website, but it's eddiemedina.com. You can also find me on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all those good places. A lot of people keep up with me mostly through Facebook and Instagram nowadays, and that's awesome. I'll have some upcoming conventions. In fact, I have somewhere in the vicinity of 8 conventions already reserved for just between January and June. I believe that I have somewhere in between 6 and 8 shows, which this is already shaping up to be my biggest year as far as the Comic-Con scene goes.
And these are all in Texas, would they be?
These are just mostly in Texas. I'm looking into going into Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Louisiana, too.
If you want to find these and other shows in Texas, in the shameless plug, be sure and check out Convention Awareness Project Texas at www.cap-tx.info.
Yeah, yeah. And that is a good resource. This is how I found some of the conventions I'm scheduled at, is because of CapTex. So definitely check it out, whether you're just a con-goer, an artist, or a vendor. It is a good resource for you to utilize.
Or if you're planning to become a show promoter and create your own shows, find out when all the other shows in Texas are going on so you're not doubling up on
a
weekend in the same city. That's something a trap a lot of first-timers fall into.
Definitely.
And with that, we will retire from that galaxy far, far away for another 2 weeks. You can catch us next week on the live show over at deepelementair.com on the Rancor Pit Live, and we will be back here in 2 weeks with more Simple Tricks and Nonsense.